Talk given Saturday, 10th April, 1976. There are those who talk of sudden enlightenment. There are others who insist upon the gradual development over a period of time, short or long, before one attains, as they say, the liberated condition or enlightenment or whatever word they like to use. We must understand that the difference between the two is not a literal difference. That is to say, what is called sudden enlightenment really implies that one has reached a critical point and then at last the result shows itself. But if that critical point is not far off, today, tomorrow, or a week hence, it will appear, perhaps to oneself also, as well as to others, that the enlightenment was sudden. Whereas, in other cases, a person will practice a discipline faithfully and strive and may realize the meaning of the deep things of life, may realize inward liberation after a very long time. I don't think there is any such thing as a true liberation, a true fulfillment, a true flowering out into one's whole humanness, just at a stroke, so to say. There is preparation beforehand. Even if that preparation consists mainly of what we commonly call a gift for something or other. One is, for instance, born a poet or a musician or a mathematician or whatever it is. He is gifted that way. In the same way, in our spiritual life, in the flowering of our humanity, one is born with a gift. We must always take that into account. We start off with a certain blueprint, so to say. This is nature's working. The chromosomes and the hormones and the genes and all the rest of it. And that is a blueprint that no one can escape. No one can avoid the workings of the body itself. The brain, the ductless glands, and the way they will function, and so forth. If one is born with a natural gift for religious insight and, don't forget this part, this is the more important part, for living the pure life simply, spontaneously. If one is born with that gift, then that person is naturally most likely going to be a saint, and perhaps if he has the intellectual equipment, he is going to be a spiritual genius. But whatever the gift may be, no one can escape the hard work of purification of the mind and the heart. The hard work of constant mindfulness, constant awareness of what one is thinking and feeling, speaking and doing. You know how, for instance, in Buddhism, you have what they call the sudden school of enlightenment. Zen people particularly talk about the sudden enlightenment. But if you look into the original texts, if you take the basic text on which all Zen Buddhism appears to be based, namely the sutra, that means the exposition, if you like, by Hui Neng, you will find certain outstanding points mentioned by him. First and foremost, that the essence of mind is utterly pure, utterly perfect, utterly untainted. In which way is this essence of mind, I'm talking of the phrase now, the phrase, essence of mind, different from other phrases, such as the divine spark within one? It is no different. It refers to the same mysterious something which is in us, which is unknown, and which in itself, in its absoluteness, always remains unknowable. Which is, if you like to use the language of the theist, it's God Himself embodied in us. You can use that language, you can use any language you like. But the important thing for us, if we are to approach this intelligently, is to understand that these phrases express an awareness in our own self of that which is utterly transcendent, but not away from us, not different from us, not other than us. This is the important thing. All right. Now, Hui Neng talks about this essence of mind. It's utterly immaculate, perfect, and so on. They like to use the phrase essence of mind. Very good. We'll take that phrase. And then, in connection with this sudden enlightenment, it comes the moment you burst through the limitations imposed upon the mind by our intellect. Our intellect is conditioned right from the beginning. What we recognize as our intellectual process is very largely a mechanical mental process. From birth onwards, the impressions which reach us are categorized. They are all named they are classified, and so forth. And all this is done especially through the use of language, words. Words do all this. And as the years pass, there are mental constructs built up, concepts. So that when the next impression comes, we utilize the concept which is already stored up in the brain. It's a brain, a pattern in the brain. We use that concept to recognize the impression that has come to us, a sight, a sound, or whatever it is. So you see, the process of living for us becomes increasingly mechanized through the domination of concepts. Concepts are indispensable because concepts structure, give structure to all our moment-to-moment daily experience. They give structure. But we get caught up in this limited sphere of our own concepts as such. And we must bear in mind that the concepts may be reasonably true to reality, reasonably correspond with objective reality, or they may be misconcepts to a very considerable extent, confused concepts, and so forth. So that our intellectual process activities limit us very considerably. Because there is this awareness of the transcendent in us, there is this extraordinary urge to break through all limitations and let that, the supreme, become realized, made real, completely and totally in us and through us. But that can happen only if we are able to dissolve away this prison house which the intellect builds for us. So there is the effort, there is the practice, the very teaching to be mindful constantly, to be aware of everything all the time, and to see things truly without letting our conditioned mind delude us with respect to them. This effort in itself is the preparation for this kind of enlightenment, as we call it. The mind as we know it, which means a collection of mental constructs, undergoes complete transformation, a complete dissolution. It's not a case of mental constructs being exchanged for other constructs. This is what we ordinarily do in our daily life as we grow and we say we become wiser. We become more and more knowledgeable, and we may become, and let us all hope that we always do become, more and more sensible in dealing with life as we go through it. But wiser in the religious sense? No. Wisdom in the religious sense is that functioning of intelligence which is utterly free of the limitations imposed by all conceptual thinking. and our whole bundle of mental constructs. That is wisdom. But through the years, as one lives the life, as we say, the power of the mental constructs to hold us enclosed lessens, it disappears. And then, when there is complete freedom from the power of the concepts to hold you imprisoned, then there is enlightenment. An experiencing of a transformed mode of consciousness altogether. So that when you see your neighbor, the next person, the person next to you, or another object, you see it quite differently from the way in which you saw it before. And the difference is of such a nature that it remains indescribable. Because all description lies enclosed within the sphere of conceptual thought. You have grown out of conceptual thought into pure thought, which is an active, creative power. So that if we use the word know, and we can't escape using the words of the dictionary, in this case, unfortunately, you know by being that which you are observing or experiencing. Not by looking at it and interpreting it according to your concepts. Now, this may happen fairly quickly. Sometimes it may happen just naturally and spontaneously altogether, apparently without any effort on one's part. You know, in Christian mysticism we have a remarkable example in Jacob Boehmer. He was a person of that type. And the Zen school of Buddhism particularly emphasizes this type of sudden illumination. We have to be very careful. Study Huineng fully, carefully. He points out very clearly that one mustn't be driven by the desire to attain. If you wish for that transcendent, immeasurable, unknown and unknowable, you may obtain your wish only in the shape of your own illusory, limited concept, impressing itself so firmly, so powerfully on the brain that you say, now I'll use theistic terms because they are much simpler for understanding, you will say, oh, God spoke to me. I have seen God. As if the unknown, the immeasurable, were an object which is a limited entity. So now, another question which arises in relation to all this, the freedom from desire, is what is it that prevents one, holds one back from becoming enlightened? the enlightening is always from within. It is the pure human blossoming into full humanity within oneself. Full humanity is identical with what man calls divinity. The great mystics of the world have talked about deification as the climax. And they have also pointed out that deification and reification, reification meaning the final, complete, perfect manifestation, making it the thing, the one and only thing, which is a no thing in our sense of the word thing, but which is the total thing, the spirit, this creative energy in itself, the absolute in itself. Deification and reification are identical. Now if you read Huineng or any of the other teachers carefully, you will find that they mention it almost in an offhand manner, that which holds us back from lighting up from within is the fact that the mind is impure. And therefore, we come back, as always, to the absolute indispensability of perfect morality. The morality of the heart, the morality of the mind. The morality of the heart, we all know. We must be truthful, we must be kind, we must be loving, and all the rest of it. Do not harm anything or anybody. Let your speech be pure and perfect and beautiful. And so forth. We know all that. And the morality of the mind means the freedom from bias, prejudice, preconceiving, and assuming. This is the unmorality of the mind, which is built into us by our socio-cultural heritage and environment. Because the mind is filled with all kinds of beliefs clad in verbal clothes. Interpreting our experience through the use of these verbal forms, we build up convictions out of our daily experience. So you get your beliefs and your convictions, and we cling to them. This is the impurity of the mind, the greed of the mind, the fear of the mind. Fear makes us cling to these ideas and beliefs and convictions. And if we have that kind of intellectual gift which can take ideas to their end point, so to say, to their culmination as ideas, we release what we call an ideal. But the ideal, whatever it may be, in whatever sphere, it is a wishful projection of our own self and our own desire to possess, to hold back. So that, you see what the morality of the mind, of the intellect implies. Now, if all this indispensable aspect is properly attended to, then the mental constructs dissolve away. We see them for what they are. They undergo change. Fresh mental constructs come into being. But as we go on, we see just what is happening, that fresh mental constructs have come into being. But now we know that no mental construct is a final truth, because truth is reality in itself, clothed as concepts and as words which express those concepts. We haven't got anything like final truth. You can't obtain final truth. You can't acquire it. You can't learn it from another. You can be it. You can't go to the kingdom of heaven and meet Mr. God. You can be so completely human, so purified, so utterly pure, so perfect, that you are what that word God means. What the word human, the happy creator, the literal meaning, the deepest meaning of the word human, you can be that yourself. But you see what has happened in this process. In being that, there is no separate self involved anymore in one's own awareness. The isolated self-consciousness with regard to oneself has completely disappeared altogether. How and why is this so? In being the happy creator, one is creative energy itself. Now, creative energy does not belong to the limited realm of entities in space-time. It's of a nature which utterly transcends the barriers imposed by our awareness, our ordinary everyday consciousness of ourselves and the world and so on, in space-time terms, which means in terms of measurement, of comparison, and so forth. And wheresoever we can measure and compare, there we have given rise, through the activity of our own mind and consciousness, to limited separate entities. And all limited separate entities come into being, go through their lifespan, and perish. So birth and death. There is birth and death here for us, remaining as we are, not the full human. So you see, in being that truth, we have done away with our entity separateness from totality. So that the very root of man's misery and sorrow has been extirpated. Selfness. This self this isolated self-consciousness, which all the time functions in terms of you and I, of that object or event and I, as two separate things. Hence the everlasting conflict, the misery, the fear, the confusion, and all the rest of it. But note carefully again, this all of us can see as a thought. It's a concept. If anyone speaks aloud and you hear, all that has taken place between the speaker and the listener is a transference or a raising up of a different concept. See? Now, as I said earlier, concepts structure our percepts. They give structure to our percepts and enable us to carry on in the ordinary way, in everyday life, in the practical life, in a sensible, healthy manner. Healthy from the point of view of separate entity physical existence. Concepts do that. But when we awaken to the fact that all concepts are limiting concepts, then if a very lucid concept or a lucid set of concepts is placed before you, and your own being, unbeknown to yourself, you never know when it is going to happen, you see, is just ready for it, suddenly the concept vanishes, it has given the necessary stimulus, the necessary impulse, and in inner consciousness you awaken to that, to the reality of totality, to the reality of transcendence. You will find it a wonderful thing to observe how the word reality is used. All the great teachers, all those who have awakened to full fruition, fulfilled the purpose of their existence, they talk about the reality of the transcendent, the reality of God, or the reality of whatever represents, whatever word represents the ultimate for them. But the word reality means that which is a thing. Comes from the Latin res, rei, rei, the genitive case. A thing. In other words, the thing of transcendence of God, the no thing. Now you see how you have broken through the barrier of intellect here. Because if you take it literally as such and you want to submit it to logical analysis, that sounds nonsense. The thing of nothing. Or the nothingness of anything. See, whilst we are conscious in terms of sense impressions, they are synthesizing by the brain, and the interpretation of that synthesis, we are within the sphere of what we commonly call logic and logical processes, which always have the either or situation functioning. It's either this or that. It's either black or white, or grey or blue, etc. It can't be everything simultaneously. And everything cannot be one thing in the immediate here now. This, as far as we are confined within the sphere of logic, within the sphere of sense perceptions and observations, and the logical intellectual processes. But this is our limited sphere. In the completely human state, the happy creator, this creative energy knows no measurement, knows no limitation, is beyond the bounds of space-time. And as and when mind and consciousness suddenly open out to that, then what happens? The thing of no thing, the nothingness of thing, and all nonsensical sounding phrases are truth. Simple as simple can be. You find not only in Zen, I'm mentioning Zen because it is emphasized in Zen more than in most other religious philosophies, not only in Zen, but in modern science now. The science of the last 15 years, they are showing clearly that we can never have any complete knowledge of any one thing or phenomenon. It is not a question for modern science to find out the facts about a particular thing or process as such. They are concerned with the network of interrelationships which constitute the event. And they know too well, they are now saying it absolutely openly, that if one thinks in terms of wanting to know all about any one thing, you'd have to know all about everything, which is impossible. So you see, the scientific approach to reality, the religious approach to reality, have completely met at last. After an enormous span of what we commonly call time. But they have met for us on this planet in time as we understand it and experience it. They may have met elsewhere in the cosmos long ago, as we would say, or will meet long afterwards, as we here would say. But once they have met, once they have really fused, which means that they are no longer still confined to the realm of concepts, to the realm of talking with each other, that minds have absolutely awoken to this altogether, there'll be no need for words and books and so forth. What we call two minds in harmony, or 2 million minds in harmony, have become one indistinguishable mind. All the different rivers flow into the one ocean. And what a curious thing it is that the world in which we live is a world of solid islands surrounded by the oceans. The oceans completely interconnect. The land surfaces don't. There is no part of the world which goes right around the world, all solid land. Is there, Michael? None whatever. He's a geographer, so he can confirm. And this is a curious thing, isn't it? So now, when, after the conceptual meeting, and for us, we can only form concepts about this, if there is this purification, this true ascesis, this true asceticism, meaning being free of all unessentials, then the mind has become a light. It is no longer a fog. It is the light itself. Now here is the miracle. Out of the finite, the fog has flashed out the infinite, the pure light of the enlightened awareness. And the finite is not shattered by it. You'll find in my new book I've used the word unshattered right at the very end. And you'll understand in which sense I've used it. There is no shattering of the finite in the realization of the infinite through the finite. And in the same way, there is no such thing as a diminution of the infinite because of the imperfections of the myriads of finite things that constitute the cosmos as you and I see it and are conscious of it. Now, if you can really grasp this, then we shall be able to understand more clearly the statement of Hui Ning, that there is no Bodhi tree. The Bodhi tree meaning the body, which the previous monk talked of, you see. There is no mirror, the mind, which the previous monk talked of, and therefore, where shall the dust, that is to say, that which obscures, that which defiles, alight? But you see, the untamed, the untrained student, the person who hasn't begun to see into the deeps of his mind and recognize the lurking greed and possessiveness and all the rest of it which is there, the untamed, untrained person gets hold of Hui Ning's statement about this and imagines himself enlightened, that he is the pure essence of mind now, he has seen it, he has understood it. Not at all. He doesn't take sufficient account. And not only Hui Ning, but the other great Zen teachers also have talked about it. He has not taken account of the indispensability of the moral purification, the morality of the heart and our daily action, the morality of the intellect. He has not taken sufficient account of it. If and when sufficient account is taken of that, and there is the real purification, then certainly there is no dust, no mirror anywhere. There is only the pure light. And that pure light functions through this flesh and blood. It transforms the finite vehicle. This is the real significance of transfiguration, which belongs not only to Christian doctrine, but also to the Buddhist doctrine, also to the Zarathustrian doctrine, also, it comes out in innumerable cases, in all the Hindu, Brahmanical teachings and so forth. In the simple expression, the usual expression in Buddhist terms, it comes out in phrases like this. When someone has seen the light, become the light, and he is walking, and another person looks at him and says, "John Smith, your face is shining." What does it mean? The person who says it has sufficient development within him to observe the fact that here is a transfiguration. So you see, we have to let the truth of all these things emerge out of our innermost depths. We have to let it emerge. Let the mind and the heart be pure. Let the attention be full and complete. And the truth will just naturally emerge out from within. Then one's eye is single, the eye which looks and sees. One's inner eye, the third eye, opens. And the whole body is full of light. Now in the Christian statement, "If thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be full of light," there is no exposition of the fact that thy whole body means not merely oneself, John Smith, but it means the total universe, because that is your real body. You see, we are so limited. This is, as I said, our conditioning from birth. The words you, I, our names, and so forth. And we become confined to limited things all the time. And this sense of awareness in terms of totality vanishes. Not that the child is born with any awareness of totality at all. The child is in totality. But the process of physical growth, biological growth, brings about distinction, separateness, and so forth. As we grow, we become more and more imprisoned. This is a necessary stage. But we can grow into the other thing. The great meaning, the great purpose of yoga, this joining as we call it, I prefer to translate yuj, the root, in this particular context. Not so much as a joining, because the moment we say joining, we think of this thing joined with that other thing. But I prefer to translate it as the restoration of the limited, the restricted, into the totality. This is the meaning of yoga. This is the meaning of the living of the holy life. Now, the essence of mind, God within you, the neshama of the Judaic teaching and the Kabbalistic teaching, the essence, the spark, the divine spark which is in you. Is it a spark? Is it in fact something we can talk about? Because all talking is restricted. Every single word has a specific limited meaning. It takes us into the realm of separate entity. Accepting the words which negate separate entity. There are a few words in the languages of the world. Infinite. Immeasurable. Absolute. Which is not the opposite of relative. Do remember that. The word relative contains within itself the whole concept and experiencing of duality and multiplicity. But the word absolute is not an opposite of relative. Just as the word silence in innermost fact is not the opposite of noise. Or harmony is not the opposite of discord. This is a better example. Concord and discord are the two words which are the opposites. Relate concord and discord in the right way and you have overriding harmony. The word harmony belongs to an absolute sphere. So now, this spark of divinity, as we call it, is the total light, the one light, within which is everything. As the Upanishadic speaker would say, Brahman is all, is the absolute all. So now, if this can go home to us, right within us, that extraordinary transformation, that transmutation of mind and consciousness takes place. And then only one knows creation. Until then we know only procreation. Whether it be biological procreation, bearing children after our own kind, that is procreation. Or cultural procreation. All our symphonies and poems and architectural works and so forth are true to type. They are related to that which went before. They emerge from our knowledge of all that. They come into being here and now as separate, specific things. But this is, we usually say that the genius creates this, that and the other. He procreates intellectually, emotionally. Creation is something which is completely beyond, completely indescribable. It is characterized by the newness which has no before or no and no after. The reality of the eternal now is inconceivable by the brain, but it is that eternal now which is here. I'm using all these words and phrases to try and suggest this reality of transcendence. This is, if one can suddenly thrill in tune with it, then it is done. It is finished. Finished in the sense of completed. The craftsman who has finished the whole thing. The perfect finish. Telaios. You see, the implications of living the religious life, the holy life, the truly human life. You can relate all this to what we considered at our previous meeting, the state of the world, its difficulties, its problems, and so forth. We, as we are trying to consider them, can do very little. I can stir mud this way, I can try another way and turn my wooden spoon or iron spoon round in another way and so forth. But as long as I'm stirring mud, it is mud. And that is what the well-meaning, sincere, however sincere they are, however clever they are, the well-meaning politicians and economists and the whole host of them are involved in this mud pie. And there they stick. Involved in this realm of dukkha, suffering, misery. Now you see why the Buddha said all existence is suffering. To exist means literally to stand out of, ex sistere, to stand out of. What am I standing out of? The truth, transcendence, this creative power, this creative energy. How am I standing out of it? By means of my mental constructs, which I do not let go, by means of the desire drive within me, the pleasure-pain drive within me, which preserves this isolative self-consciousness. Therefore, all standing out of the transcendent reality, out of the kingdom of heaven, out of nirvana, out of liberation, etc., the liberated state, out of humanity, the standing out of whatever the external shapes may be, whatever we do to make it seem pleasant, it is all suffering. It is all ill, the ill state. Dukha, far from the infinite.